Would you recognize a billionaire if they walked up to you? Or after you had talked to someone, would you know they were a billionaire when they walked away? On this episode of the Grow With Tim podcast, we're going to chat about billionaire patterns. Welcome back to the Grow With Tim podcast. It has been a while. I'm your host, Jay Du. This is my co-host, Tim. Tim Joyner, you have something on your mind today that we've been really excited about as we've talked through and around this idea of some of your newest friends or people in your Rolodex now. So let's jump into it.
Yeah, over the last couple of years, I have gotten to meet and not just meet, like shake their hand, but spend significant time with a handful of billionaires. Certified people with a lot of zeros in their net worth. And I've noticed some differences, right? They think differently, they act differently, they talk differently than your average person. And I've been working for a while to catalog those differences. And I think I've come up with some patterns that I want to share today.
Okay, so first off, you said certified billionaires. How do we get that certification? I want to know.
Well,
am I on this list? Do I have these attributes?
Yeah, ask Mr. Forbes, I guess.
Okay,
400 gotcha. Or whatever. But no, they are some really enormously successful people, and somehow, often through M3, a group that you and I have been a part of before, I've gotten a chance to meet these people and have meals with them and spend significant time, multiple days in some cases. And I've been asking a lot of questions, taking a lot of notes, and I've got some of their collective wisdom to share today.
Okay, so as you leave a meeting with a billionaire, a certified billionaire, what are some of these patterns you're starting to notice?
Yeah, so the first one is about the people on their teams. Very, very rarely do you have a really successful person who's done it on their own. That's almost unheard of. They're usually involving large teams, but not just any teams. They hire the best people they can find. And I hear that again and again and again.
Right.
I told you, even on this podcast, one of the first times I got exposed to one of those really successful people that was way out of my league, he's actually been on this podcast, Eric Weir. And I got an opportunity to fly with him on his private jet to the wedding of a mutual friend. And I asked him, what do you know now that you wish you knew at my age?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And his answer, I won't tell you the whole story because we've told it before, but he said, I used to hire good people that were loyal. They were well-meaning, but
familiar to me.
That's right.
Things like
family
that.
Family and friends,
yeah.
And people that were looking for a job. And he said, now I hire the best people and I pay 15 or 20% more than market so that they're not tempted to go anywhere else. And he said, I ran a deficit for a while. I was losing money, but within, I think he said 8 or 10 months, he was in the black and he's never looked back. He
right. says
that he's so much more successful. He's got better quality of life, more freedom of time, all these things. That was really the first time I started thinking about, like, at the time, I was trying to pay people below market.
Like, right, right.
I can't afford to pay over market.
Sure.
I don't have any money.
Yeah.
And for him to say, I hire the best people, that was really eye-opening. And since then, as I've met all these billionaires, they all talk about hiring really smart people, the best educated, the people with the greatest work ethic,
mm-hmm.
That have experience, that have been there, done that. They all hire really great people. So that's the first thing. I was just with Jeff Hoffman here a few weeks ago. Jeff's the guy that invented the airport kiosk, the check-in kiosk, right?
Right, right.
Boarding pass. Now being supplanted 25 years later by the phone, right? Now
sure,
you don't need it.
Of
but
course.
For a long time, it was revolutionary. Every airport in America has dozens or hundreds of these things, right?
Sure, right.
He gets a piece of all those. He owns
Ain't
the IP.
That something, yeah.
And he was a co-founder of Priceline and later UBID, a couple of other billion-dollar companies. And he talked about this. And he said there was a time when he looked at his business partner and he said, you know, we could go into any business we want. We could shut down the doors to Priceline and go to a completely different industry.
Okay.
And we would still win because we have the best team in the world.
Mm.
And he talked about how they hired the best people.
Right.
One of his phrases was hire hard, manage easy.
Okay.
And I love that.
You
spend a lot of time finding the best person. You hire hard, manage easy.
Do you think that many folks who listen to this podcast or folks you've been associated with in business are not yet doing that? They've not yet cracked the code on best people first.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of really good companies really good entrepreneurs that have built amazing companies that have hired good people. And it's like a cheat code. It's like you want to level up, hire great people, hire the best people, and surround yourself with the best people. And it really is like a cheat code. And I think there are a lot of people that haven't figured that out yet.
I think I've heard it played out this way. Maybe it was through Jim Collins's work. We've all heard of that and read that, Good to Great. But it was, you find the best people and you put them on the best opportunities, not the problems.
That's right.
And I think a lot of times, probably starting out in business, you want to get rid of things that you'd consider problems. So you put people on problems to get them out of your vision, out of your sight lines, and off to the peripheral. But great people don't even like to fix problems.
Right.
They like ideas and opportunities for the future. So I think I feel that when you say it, but you probably at a different level in business, we haven't realized it in our lives, in our business yet. We just, I've heard that.
Right.
Is that true? Should I do that?
And I would say that by and large, I'm thinking of all the people that have ever worked for me or with me, a lot of really great people. I'm not here to diss on anybody. But for most of my life, I have not really been able to afford people who have years of experience who are really the best at that thing. Doesn't mean they're a bad person, but there have been a few times where I have hired the best. And sure enough, it's just like all these billionaires say, it will transform a business. And I could tell you, I won't, because I don't want to name names and then exclude all the people who weren't the greatest. But there are a couple people I'm thinking of that are just head and shoulders above everybody else. And it has transformed those businesses. So I'm starting to taste that. And I want to taste a lot more of it in my next business.
Give us pattern number two.
Pattern number two. They are all unreasonably persistent. I say unreasonable because you or I or the average person would look at them and say, that's crazy. That's not even natural. It's unnaturally persistent. You and I were together with Drayton McLean, one of the billionaires on our list, down in Temple, Texas a year or two ago. And he told story after story about how he was persistent. But the interesting thing was he wasn't making a point about being persistent. To him, it was just normal.
It was to him storytelling. This is how we got the deal done.
But to everybody else, it was like, that's crazy persistent.
Right.
He told the story. I've told the story before, so I'll tell the short version of it, about how he got the 7-Eleven account. And he worked really hard to find who the buyer was, the buyer for 7-Eleven, and he wanted to sell his grocery distribution business to him or the services of that business. And so he spent a whole day rewriting. This was back before computers. He handwrote it.
Uh-huh.
Wrote it, rewrote it, edited it, thought through it, and sent off this letter. And he gets it back a week later with two words scrawled across the bottom, not interested.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Undeterred, a month later, he writes another letter, handwritten, really strategic, sends it off, no response this time. Another letter, right? And no response. And anybody else would have given up.
Right.
And this is not like mail merge, like, let me dash off a quick email.
No. Yeah, sure.
Months and months go by, and he gets a phone call, as I recall, and the buyer, not a word since, not interested, right? He gets a call, and he says, Drayton, I'll be in your office at 10 o'clock tomorrow. Let's get this deal done.
Right.
And it's like, and to him, it was just routine. But
that's how we get it done around here.
Who else would do that?
Yeah.
He talked about getting the Walmart account. He
drove
from Temple, Texas to Bentonville, Arkansas. It's a long drive. No appointment. He talks his way into a meeting with Sam Walton. He pitches him. Sam's like, yeah, I'm not interested. Comes back another month. Gets another meeting, not interested. Finally, Sam says, look, Drayton, I don't need anything you're selling.
Right.
I've got more trucks and bigger warehouses and better distribution and logistics. I don't need you. Quit wasting our time.
Right.
He still doesn't give up. He says, all right, Sam, fair, but someday you're going to have a problem that you don't know how to solve. And when you have that problem, I want you to call me and I'm going to solve it for you. A little more time goes by. Sam Walton decides to launch the first Super Walmart.
Right.
He's going to put a grocery store inside a Walmart, a dry goods store.
We all remember that. Right. Yeah.
Well, Sam knows how to, sell sweaters. Sam knows how to sell dog food, but fresh vegetables and fruits and things that have a shelf life measured in hours or days, not weeks or months. He didn't know how to do that. So he calls up Drayton McLean, and Drayton builds him the first grocery store inside and then grew it from there and eventually sold his business to Sam Walton for north of $1 billion.
I think we've all heard of those guys at this point, or at least what they did to the American economy.
The thing that's amazing to me is how persistent they are.
Right.
Drayton didn't give up when Sam said, quit wasting my time.
Yeah.
Right? He keeps persisting. Jeff Hoffman. I was just with him, so I'll tell you one more story and we move on. He talked about how he raised money. And I won't go into all the details, but he actually tracked down the person that he wanted to get an investment from. And he spent a long time finding this person, picking this person. He knew that this guy invested in his type of business. He knew if he could just get a meeting, he could pitch this guy successfully.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he calls and he calls and he calls. And the secretary gets mad at him and like, stop calling. I gave him the message. If he wants to talk to you, he'll talk to you. He'll call you back. So then he starts emailing. Well, the same secretary blocks him and says, I'm going to block your email now. You know, don't quit it. Eventually, he figures out that this guy is going to be at a polo competition. This is amazing.
Right.
Flies across the country, shows up, spends all day trying to get to this guy's tent.
And thousands of dollars.
Yes.
Thousands upon thousands of dollars.
It's a VIP only section.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The security guard, like, you need a red wristband to get by there, buddy. You can't. And so he's asking everybody, how do I get a red wristband? Like, how do I? And he's not giving up. He's spending his whole day there. Finally, he finds out that if you have a yellow wristband, you can go, which you can buy, you can go to this buffet tent, and that's where the VIPs eat also. So, okay, he goes and buys the yellow wristband or whatever, and he goes and he hangs out for 2.5 hours just like nibbling at his food, waiting for this guy to come, gets in line. Finally, the guy comes and gets in line, gets in line behind him, strikes up a conversation, you know, and eventually says, you know, I just don't know a lot about polo. I'm here. It's my first competition. I'm hoping to find somebody that, you know, knows about it and can answer my questions. And of course, this guy loves it.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, well, what do you want to know? I'll tell you.
Yeah.
I love polo. So they talk, and eventually he invites him back to the tent and goes by the security guard. You know, sorry, that's a VIP. He's with me. Come on by.
Right.
And eventually the guy finally says, well, I'm so embarrassed. I've been talking about myself and about polo all day. I don't even know what you do for a living. Oh, I got this travel tech business that I'm really, I invest in those kinds of business.
Right.
Tell me more. Right. Shows up the next morning for a meeting and the rest is history.
Right.
But being unreasonably persistent is they just all tell those stories like, of course, doesn't everybody do that? Well, no, the answer is not everybody does that. But really successful people persist.
So I'm going to go off the beaten path for a second and talk about somebody who I have heard of. And in an urban environment have idolized in terms of business savvy and interest. And some of our listeners out there, maybe one or two, may have heard of or maybe like the style of Lil Wayne.
Yeah, right.
So we've got this entrepreneur and business mogul, but we all really know him as a rapper, right? He's a very much 21st century rapper who grew up in Louisiana in the project, single mom, that type of thing. And the persistent story caught my attention when you told me about Jeff Hoffman and what he's done to find investors. The Cash Money record label, you know, you remember, right, Tim?
Oh, of course.
Of course. Of course.
I'm very much into rap.
Yes, right. Okay. So he's maybe about 12 years old, I heard. And he was calling in to try to get studio time, trying to get a record deal, because that's what he wanted to do with his life. And this is before he's Lil Wayne. I guess he's really Little Wayne at this point. He's 12 years old. Yeah. I think he's in the sixth grade at this point. And eventually, after several calls and trying to pitch his ideas, pitch his raps, pitch some music to these executives, which I believe in the Cash Money world or set of brothers, they started to ignore him. We're not interested. We've heard this before. Drayton's story, Jeff's story with his gatekeeper. We're not interested. We don't need you, that type of thing. Well, turns out he had started to decide every day I'm going to call. I'm going to get the voicemail, he realizes eventually. They just stopped picking up. Answering machine. Yeah. Answering machine. And he just decided to rap on the answering machine.
Yeah.
Every day. He would just do it once every day. And no responses, nothing. And eventually the record producers had to cut a label or cut some tracks for a artist. And they needed one more song on the record. And they said, let's call that kid. Let's call that kid. He's got something. Surely he's got something. And now, in terms of that sphere of influence, Lil Wayne is the one we all have heard of and know. You know the label Cash Money, but all these other artists that had probably been tenured, worked with them on several different projects, we don't know them. We know the one that was persistent.
Yeah.
And I've heard things about his style. It's like, no matter what, rain or shine, he just records every day.
Yeah.
That's what he does. But, hey,
he's
that persistent. Started when he was 12. You know?
He's persistent.
I like that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, how about the next idea?
One more thing before we leave that. What allows you to be that persistent? I think this is there's an important caveat here. Most people would look at what these billionaires have done and say that's impossible. Like if you look at their origin story, right? Many of them actually raised by single moms, very poor. None of these people that I'm talking about were born with a silver spoon in their mouth. And all of their friends, they would have these crazy dreams about what they're going to do. And all their friends would look at them and say, that's impossible, right? Jeff Hoffman said, there's a big difference between possible and probable. Was it probable that I would invent the airport kiosk and launch Priceline and these other things, right? No, it's not probable. Is it possible? Yes. And he says the difference between probable and possible is like being in a dark room and cracking the door open. If it's impossible, the door is shut. If it's just improbable, it's like just a sliver of light that's coming through that door. And he said, what's the difference now? Well, now I have just enough light to see opportunities. Mm. The opportunities were there all along.
Right.
But with that sliver of light, I can see opportunities. And that reminds me of what Dan Sullivan says. We've quoted him many times on this show. He says, my eyes only see and my ears only hear what my brain is looking for. I'm going to give that to you again. My eyes only see, my ears only hear what my brain is looking for. So as long as my brain is saying that's impossible, I'm not looking for it.
Right.
If I'm saying, it's not probable, but it's possible.
Right.
It's like a little ray of light. And now I see opportunities that nobody else sees and I can now move to seize them. And that's what these guys have done again and again. They see the same opportunity that all of us have access to, but they take it because their brain isn't saying that's impossible.
And of course, we can have that laser focus and tunnel vision toward the only light in the room. That's what I kind of feel and take from a quote like that or an analogy like this dark room is that's the only thing that I see because the room is dark to me. The room is dark to me. Well, the next person may see different objects in the room or have a seat in the corner and say it's over. Well, if you've got something to focus on, you can move toward it.
Yep. Yep. And being open to opportunities that most people wouldn't even try to seize. Well, that's for other people. That's not the kind of person I am. Well, why isn't it?
Yeah. Maybe decide you're the other people, at least for the things that you want.
All right. So number one, they all hire great people. Mm-hmm. Number two, they're unreasonably persistent. The third thing that I've noticed in most of these guys is that they have this really hyper laser focus on one thing.
Mm.
Now, you and I are not very good at that.
No,
at least I'm not very good at that.
Right, right.
I need to work in this area. I have many interests, and I run multiple businesses. You do too. Most of these guys, though, have said, I'm going to focus on the one thing where I can achieve a gold medal. Like, I'm going to be the best at this one thing, and it's going to take all of my focus and energy and resources, time, attention, to focus on this one thing and become the best at it. So you've got a guy like Jeff Bezos, right? Jeff, from the very beginning, was going to be the world's marketplace. But he said, I'm going to be the best blank, blank bookseller on the planet.
Yeah.
And all he sold was books
until
he was the best. He won a gold medal in that category. And then he started expanding, and now he's all kinds of stuff, right? Even somebody like Richard Branson, who people point to and say, well, there's a parallelpreneur, right? He's done a lot of things. He would tell you, I did them one at a time. I was all in on Virgin Records. I was all in on Virgin Airlines or all these different things that he's launched. He did them one at a time, and then he got a management team in place, hired a CEO. He stepped out, and he would tell the CEO, like, success for you means you don't call me asking questions. Like, it's your business. He, of course, is a major investor.
Of course,
he's going to move on. So anyway, they all have this laser-minded focus. And what I think that allows you to do, it gives you great clarity about what you say no to. And you say no to a lot of things. There are a lot of good opportunities. And I heard all of these billionaires talk about all these opportunities that when you've got money, everybody wants you to invest, right? Everybody is pitching you all the time and they say no a lot. But when you have this clear no, that's not what I do, it allows you to say this really strong yes to the things that are actually what you're on the planet to do. So I think this narrow focus, winning a gold medal in your category, this was interesting. One of them said, if people aren't breaking down your door trying to give you money, maybe you're in the wrong business. And I thought, well, wait a minute. I've never owned a business where people are breaking down the door to try to give me money. But actually, maybe not all, but most of these guys and women, one woman, most of them have had businesses like that where it's such a blue ocean strategy where there's no competition and they have such a differentiated product that creates so much value. People are like throwing money at them. I keep talking about Jeff because I was just with him, but I could tell stories about other ones too. But in the early days of the airport kiosk, right, all these airlines were literally like trying to overnight checks to him to get deposits on how fast can you build me these kiosks? And others talk about that as well. So you pick a category where you can win a gold medal and you put all your energy in that one thing. A lot of people talk about multiple streams of income. Well, the way to achieve wealth is to have 21 streams of income or whatever. And I've pursued that, and it's worked out very well for me. I have a very comfortable lifestyle. I've got more than 21 streams of income. It's great. There's nothing wrong with it. But I'm not yet a billionaire.
Sure.
And if I want to go from being pretty successful to crazy successful, it's probably going to take more focus. And not that that's the only right way. I'm
of
not
course,
saying that
yeah.
That, it, well, I don't necessarily aspire to that.
Very recently,
but if you want to change the world, you're going to have to focus on
very recently, we've all seen Alex Hormozi. If you're into this type of thinking pattern, you're into this podcast, you're going to know who that influencer is. $100 million leads and acquisition.com, et cetera. You've seen him out there. And recently, I've seen something as we record this in early summer of 2025. That somebody said to him, with all of this content you've got out there and all of these sources of influence, if everything disappeared, what is about 1 minute's worth of everything so far? What would you tell the world? And I thought that was great. A great question. And he's mentioned several times of all the requests he gets to be on people's shows, he only is going on the ones where people ask good and interesting questions.
That's a great question. What's the answer?
And the answer was he took a minute. You can tell he took some time. Everything is edited these days. But he really sat there for a second. He's not in a rush. And he said, you got to figure out what you want. You've got to ignore what everyone else says about that. Ignore the opinions of everyone else. And then work so hard, it would be unreasonable that you don't achieve it. Mm. And I thought, isn't that beautiful? Mm. Now, that reminds me in this persistence area, as well as clear and narrow focus, Arnold Schwarzenegger. So I have to mention these two guys who in pop culture everybody knows, because I haven't gotten to meet as many billionaires as Tim. So everybody knows the Governator. They know Arnold, right? They know the Terminator. And we all know that his origin story is quite literally in Austria. And he is forced to join the military in that country during that time. And these are the sons of actual Nazis at this point. You know, war is over. He's obviously younger, the next generation, but the previous generation were in that category. And so they've got a very 1960s-style regimented disciplinary culture, right? I don't think he talks about it in terms of how happy and healthy it was.
Right.
And he's in the military, right. So we all understand right. This is a regimented thing. Well, he is doing his bodybuilding at that time. He started when he was about 15 years old, and he's 18, and he needs to get to the next country over. I don't know if it was Germany or some other place at this time, but I read his book called Fantastic, if you want to look this up. And he's got to figure out how to defect from the army to be in the competition. And so he does. I mean, he literally shows up. He doesn't speak the language. So I guess it's not Germany. I obviously it's the same language. But he shows up, can't speak the language, realize he doesn't have trunks, right? Little bikini bottoms. He doesn't have anything because he literally crossed the border, hopped on a train, and hoboed his way to this event. So he gets someone else's trunks that he can use and he poses. He wins. He had determined that he was going to, at 15 years old, the very first time he worked out, he realized what his path was going to be. He wanted to be a champion in that space. But at this point, I think, around the time he's joined the military, he's got a 2-year stint, as far as I recall, he's going to move to Hollywood. He is going to become a Mr. Olympia champion several times over. He's going to get into acting, and then he's going to get into politics. He had it planned out. And he knew what he wanted, so he knew what to avoid. And one of the reasons, which I think we're getting to right now in your next pattern, that he wanted when he showed up to California a few years later, not speaking English at all, showed up at Mr. Gold's gym, he had one at that time, because of distribution. He knew that if he got into that mail order business, that his product or his pictures or his physique could be spread. Mm. And he was going to use what I think is coming up for you.
Yeah. Leverage. Yeah. That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's such an interesting story. Before we move on to leverage, I'll just observe that is a two-edged sword. I think having clarity about what it is that you want and then pursuing that single-mindedly with great focus and persistence, you can achieve almost anything that you want. You can't achieve everything, but you can achieve almost anything.
The other part about, you know, his particular situation is, I mean, he was on the verge of getting court-martialed for defecting.
Interesting.
I mean, he didn't have permission to leave.
Yeah.
And he came back to the Army, got disciplined, and was told that I think he had to work in the mess hall in the kitchen or something like that, some sort of punishment. And he realized that because he was in the kitchen, he could get more food and he needed more calories.
The
types of things. Yeah, he used everything that was around him to be able to,
Well, I say that it's a danger because, you know, it's possible to want the wrong things. Mm. I think of that in, you know, child rearing. We both got young kids and teaching them to want the right things, right? First Timothy says the love of money is the root of all evil.
Right,
and
it's
possible for us as highly successful entrepreneurs to actually get fixated on the wrong things that we can achieve. And then we get to the end of our life and say, oops, we were chasing the wrong squirrel.
But, right.
All right. So the last thing that I noted, not the last thing, the last thing we're going to talk about today, notice a lot of other things, is that they all use leverage. They all figure out a way because they all have the same, you know,
24 hours a day. Right.
Most of them didn't have, you know, huge trust accounts that they inherited or whatever. So how do they take what they have and get bigger results than everybody else? They all use leverage. And I identified four types of leverage. Most of them use, I think all of them use at least two. Most of them use at least three. A couple of them used all four types of leverage. Number one is the leverage that we all think about. It's capital. It's money, right? It's easier to make money if you have money. You can invest, you can buy businesses, you can buy stocks and bonds, you can hire more employees. Like, it's easier to make money if you have money. And so you might say, well, I don't have any money, so that's out for me. Well, no, actually, most of these guys didn't have money.
Right.
But they still figured out how to leverage capital.
Mm-hmm.
They borrowed from banks. They got investors to invest in them. They structured deals where the customer paid for the product, like in pre-orders before they even built the product. So they used customers to finance. They came up with creative ways, but they all leverage capital. And for me, I think the easiest way for us to get into leverage is in real estate. Real estate is brilliant because any bank will lend you money on a cash flowing asset that's, you know, backed by real estate. The thing that you're trying to buy becomes the collateral. It's brilliant. And I've had a lot of success with that. But you can also borrow money for businesses. You can borrow money for intellectual property. There are lots of ways to either borrow money or get a seller to finance. You're buying a business from a seller or buying real estate from a seller that will finance it for you. There's ways to get investment.
Right.
Lots of creative ways. But even if you don't have money, don't like cross that off your list and say, oh, that's impossible. There are ways to leverage capital, even if you don't have money. All right, so that's number one. The second form of leverage is people. We talked about hiring great people, but all of them figure out how to, look, if we've got a bunch of stuff we want to get done and it's just us or just the two of us, it's going to take a lot of time. But if we can hire somebody that can help us do those things and we can focus on the things that we're really good at and hire people to do the things that they're really good at, and then you multiply and you add more and more specialists, and everybody's doing what they are uniquely gifted at, what they have energy to do, they love to do, we're doing what we love to do, that's a form of leverage. And in the same 24 hours, you achieve much bigger results.
Right.
So they all leverage people. So I would say if somebody's listening to this and they are a successful solopreneur or they've got a small team, say, well, why am I content with just one or with just five or with just 50? What if I hired more people? What if I got a COO? What if I got a personal assistant? What if I hired a leadership team and scaled this thing out? What if I had twice as many people on my team as what I do now? Could I be twice as successful or maybe 3 or 4 or 10 times as successful? They all leverage people. The third form of leverage is technology. Technology, especially in our generation, is this crazy field leveler.
Right. Yeah.
It used to be if you wanted to reach 1 million people, you had to spend a whole bunch of money, get on primetime television.
Mm-hmm.
Now with TikTok and YouTube and Instagram, like you
It might be tomorrow for free.
For free.
Yeah.
But technology, the way that we can communicate, I mean, you and I can have meetings with people in India, with people in the Philippines, with people, you and I have had meetings with people in India and the Philippines today.
Right. Right.
We don't have to spend a lot of money on a plane ticket. And that's technology. But there are other forms of technology, automation systems, communication tools. These people that really achieve outsized results all figure out how to leverage technology in ways that nobody else is. And sometimes it's their own proprietary technology, right? They invent something. Sometimes they license intellectual property that somebody else invented. Sometimes it's just off-the-shelf stuff like project management software or artificial intelligence or planning tools or communication tools like Zoom, but they all leverage technology.
Right. Oh, yeah.
All right. So homework for you is think about what technology do I have in my business? You say, well, I'm not a tech person. Hire somebody that is. Go find a consultant. Do a little research. Learn how to use ChatGPT or other AI tools. Figure out how can I leverage the technology that's available to me so that you and I in the same amount of time, right, the one that's leveraging technology is going to get more done and create more value in the same 24-hour day. The fourth thing is brand. Many of these people have leveraged a brand. I've been in branding and marketing most of my life, so it sort of comes intuitively to me, but I think a lot of people don't understand the value of a brand.
Okay.
Let's say that you and I are competitors. We're in the same business, same industry, but I have a stronger brand than you. We can spend the exact same amount of money in advertising. I'm going to get a better ROI, but it's not just in advertising. I can spend the same amount of money in recruiting.
Right.
I'm going to get a better ROI. I can spend the same amount of money and effort in operational excellence or in research and development or any of 100 things. I'm going to get a better return because I have a better brand. So when it comes to entrepreneurs, sometimes it's their personal brand that they need to build, right? Doing things like this, like podcasts or shorts or reels, creating opportunities to speak on stage or write books or creating their personal brand. But for their companies, certainly brand building is one of those investments that pays off for the rest of your life. And most of these guys have both personal brands and company brands. All four of those things, capital, people, technology, and brand, form leverage such that their input yields a bigger output than everybody else.
What I think is quintessential here, once again, as we near the end of our episode today, is that this podcast is all about growth. And when we look at these particular categories, when we looked at the leverage and these four kind of multipliers that you've identified talking to people, it really is about growth. And so the growth-minded entrepreneur is going to seek for these things, not be satisfied until there's another level of actualization or success. And it's also good to be reminded not everybody's at that stage in life. That's not what they want. But the people who seek it can find it. And there are patterns.
For sure.
And there are things that we can do. And so for most of the people who are probably watching, listening to us right here on Grow with Tim, they're like, yeah, that sounds interesting. That sounds like something I'm not doing right now, or I'm ignoring, or I didn't realize that I now have permission from these billionaires to do it like them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. I think a lot of this is, it's one reason why I love spending time with people that are more successful than I am, that have bigger teams, that are smarter than I am, that are older and wiser than I am, because it changes your thing. It's like you use the word permission. Yeah, it gives you permission to think differently than you ever thought before. And if you are the biggest fish in your pond and you're the most successful person in your network, you're probably going to plateau pretty quick.
Sure.
But if you are hanging out with people that are smarter, more successful than you are, that think differently than you do, it challenges your thinking and it gives you permission to think bigger. And back to that possible versus probable thing, like if you're not looking for opportunity or you're not expecting it or you're saying that's impossible, you're never going to see it. And hanging out with people like this allows you to see opportunity that nobody else sees and then seize it.
This week earlier, we have a coaching relationship and you've taken the reins to facilitate some great thinking models for me and some partners. And I asked you, can I have more or less internally, because I'm the one who said it and I'm the one who thought it just this Monday. Hey, Tim, can you talk a little bit about if this style of work for me is viable?
Yeah.
I wanted the permission.
Yeah.
I said, what if I can sit down at my terminal for a couple of hours a day and think, make good decisions, talk to great people for execution, but like maybe I'm not hitting any buttons.
Right.
Is that okay?
Right.
You know, is that a model you've seen?
Yes.
Would that be viable for my personality? And you're like, yeah, yeah. Of course. Let's talk about that, and let's, like, you know, manage some expectations, think about some tools. And I was like, okay, good, 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 good. Because that's what, you know, I'm thinking about growth for me in that area. And I know that that for me is the style of work that I enjoy.
I had breakfast this morning with an entrepreneur who recently sold a business for a lot of money. And he now has more time on his hands than he's ever had before. And he's like, Tim, what do I do with my time? Like, I'm supposed to be doing stuff. Like, I show up at the office for 50 hours a week, and suddenly I don't have to do that. And he was kind of lost. And I think a lot of us think that in order to be successful, we have to do a lot. We have to work a lot. And your question was like, can I think and lead and make decisions? And you almost felt a little guilty, like, well, is that really work? Right?
Sure.
And, and I think a lot of people think that way. But, you know, these people on this list, a lot of them don't own computers. I mean, they own thousands of computers.
Right, sure.
But
yeah,
but there's no computer on that guy's desk. And he's not actually doing anything. He's thinking a lot.
Yeah.
She's making really big decisions. She's pulling big levers. She's hiring the right people. But she's not executing anything.
So what's interesting to me is this morning's meeting for me was a guy who's now in his retirement stage and phase of life, and I went to his home. And so my morning meeting, I walked in, take a look to the left, and we all know in many homes that's the area and the nook for the office. So I'm looking at his office, beautiful, well done, no computer.
Yeah.
And he said, well, that's my office. And come on in here and let's. And I said, does anything happen in here? Well, no, it just looks pretty good. You know, same thing. And I asked him later, what is he doing? Getting a lot of consulting done and this, that, and the third in that stage of life and what he wants to do. But same thing.
Yeah.
Like, well, I mean, it looks really good, doesn't it? He wanted to show it to me, but I was like, you don't work there, do you?
Right.
There's not, what would I do?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. A lot of people are like, man, if I'm not, but honestly, you ought to hire people that are better at doing all the things than you are.
Right, right, right.
You're the quarterback. You're the visionary. And it doesn't mean you're lazy. You're working hard.
No, no, he's working.
But you're thinking, you're making decisions, you're coordinating teams, but you may not do a whole lot.
There we go. All right, we'll take us to some bonus takeaways, Tim, and what we need to think about moving forward away from this episode.
So there are just a couple of interesting little tactical ideas that I picked up that I thought would be fun to share. So one idea that Jeff had that I really liked was, he says every year around the beginning of the year, he takes out a sheet of paper and he writes down what a good year is going to look like. All the metrics, the KPIs. So we're going to, you know, maybe make this many pitches and we're going to raise this much money and we're going to sell this many products and generate this kind of revenue and profit and whatever, all these different kinds of metrics. And then he flips over the page and he says, this is what a bad year is going to look like. We only sell this much. We only hire this many people. We only whatever, right? And then he takes that paper around to all of his stakeholders and he has them sign it. Why would you do that? Well, he says to his key employees, his leadership team, he says, basically, we're all getting agreement about what we expect from a good year and what a bad year looks like. And he says, you're basically pre-signing your firing, your pink slip, right?
Okay.
If our year looks like this, we're not going to be able to keep everybody around. Don't be surprised if some pink slips come out if we have a year like this. If we have a year like this other side, the good side, then that's when the bonuses flow. Like that's what's supposed to happen.
Right.
He goes to investors and says, look, we're in growth mode. We're raising money. We're going to come back to you for asking for more money. And I want a pre-agreement. Like if we have the year that we say we're going to have, this really good year, you're like pre-agreeing to write a big check next year to fund continued growth. If we have a year like the backside, I'm not going to come ask for money. Right. But he gets agreement among his whole team that this is what a good year looks like and this is what we're shooting for. I thought that was interesting, just a practical tool to set expectations and even visualize what you want to achieve and then work a plan to achieve it. That was one of the cool ideas. Another one is before and after proposals. This is kind of an obvious thing, but I had never thought of it before. I've written thousands of proposals in my life for various products and services, but usually it's like, you know, here's what I think it'll do for you, and here's the value, and here's how it'll work, all the logistics and payment terms and all that stuff. He says most of his proposals, even for $100 million deals, are two pages, two separate sheets of paper. It's a before and an after.
Okay.
Now, that's really interesting.
He I like the part where it's just two pages.
Right,
first off.
Right.
Yes.
He does a lot of research, or his team does research, and he says, this is the status quo, Mr. Client, Mr. Prospect. Right now, you're spending this much money on X, Y, and Z. You've got this many man hours dedicated to it. You're achieving this kind of a profit margin, whatever it is. Like, he knows your business better than you do. And he's going to say, this is before. This is without me. This is the current status quo. This other, now I'm going to give you a second piece of paper. This is what it looks like if we sign this deal. You're going to make this much money. You're going to achieve this level of efficiency. You're going to have this much profit. You're going to increase your customer satisfaction score, whatever. He gives them a before and after that makes it really obvious, not just how much money they're going to spend and what, it's not just a sales pitch. It's like a pro forma projection of the value he's going to create.
Okay.
And he said, it makes it really easy for people to make decisions. When you go to an airline and you say, right now the average wait time is 49 minutes. People are standing in line at the airport, 49 minutes for a clerk to push a button and print out a boarding pass. 49 minutes. With my solution, the average wait time is going to be 5 minutes. Right now, you're spending $4.7 million a month on personnel. And with my solution, you're going to cut that in half and save $2 million a year. Customer satisfaction right now with the airlines, with your particular airline, it's 27% positive approval rating. And our projections show that it's going to go up by XYZ percentage. And he just lays out before and after,
right.
And like everybody signs, everybody says yes.
Makes it clear. Makes,
I thought the before and after was
like
a cool
idea. I like that.
Last thing I'll share before we wrap up today, Jeff had a really interesting idea about how to raise money. I'm not an expert on raising money. I've done it a few times. I've raised a few million dollars, but nowhere on the scale that these billionaires have.
Right.
And most people, even most of these people, say things like, well, Tim, you're going to have to get 100 no's before you get one yes. You've got to be really persistent. You got to beat the bushes. And Jeff said, if you're beating the bushes, maybe you're beating the, like if you're getting 100 no's, you're probably beating the wrong bushes. Those bushes were never going to say yes in the first place.
Okay.
So he had a really interesting approach that I've been thinking about. He says, when he tried to raise money for Priceline, he spent a lot of time researching all the people in travel technology. And he researched them thoroughly. He read every single press release that they'd ever put out. And he really got to know them well. He knew which ones worked and which ones didn't, which ones succeeded, which ones failed. And he looked at who invested, which is, oh, there's always a press release when somebody closes around.
Yeah.
And he said he figured out the investors, and then he found the most prolific investors who invest in all the travel tech stuff. And then he figures out who is the person at that firm that handles that investment. And then he laser focuses on that one person. He says, this guy invests in all the – and then he goes to that person. He's really persistent and really strategic about how to – he goes to the polo match.
There you go, right.
To find him. And then he says, I understand that you've invested in this business, this business, this business. This one succeeded. This one didn't. And here's why I think this one succeeded and this one failed. And by the way, I'm learning from these mistakes, and I'm going to build a business like this one that succeeded wildly, and here's why.
Yeah.
And here's what I need. Here's the opportunity. And he goes with this really strategic approach, and he doesn't get 100 no's. He might only talk to three people to raise the money that he's asking for. And I just thought that approach of researching all your competitors and then who's the investors, who's the most prolific investor, who's the guy, what does he care about, why did he succeed, why did he fail, you give all that information and you make the pitch with a laser focus of that guy, and you walk away with maybe one big check that gets you everything you need. So much simpler, so much faster, so much less stress, so much less rejection. I thought that was a cool way to raise money. So I haven't done it yet.
Okay.
I'll let you know after I've tried it out.
We will. We'll
but
have
I really like the idea.
We'll have that episode coming to you soon when this man goes and finds those specific and strategic patterns to employ to make all of us and you, our stakeholders here at Grow With Tim, a lot of money. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to today's Grow With Tim podcast. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to show us some love by following us here and on our other social media platforms. You'll find all the links at growwithtim.com.